He's been kind of a regular guest, occasional guest anyway, on All About Living. And I am absolutely privileged that he would take time from his short stay here in Madison and a very, very busy time to come to the WTDY studios and do this interview, have this conversation with me. So this is actually Thursday, October 20th, and you will be hearing this on October 22nd. So if there are things that happen in between the 2 days and we talk about them, it's that we weren't on top of it on Thursday morning. But maybe you've guessed that joining me today is Jeremy Suri, Professor Jeremy Suri, who was with the University of Wisconsin-Madison here. He was a professor of history and director of the European Union Center of Excellence here at our university of Wisconsin-Madison, and he left this year for Texas, of all places. And he is spending his first semester as the holder of the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs at the Robert S. Strauss Center for International Security and Law, with a joint appointment at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs and the History Department at the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin. Wow, with a title like that, I mean, what is, does this mean that you wear many, many different hats, or is this just one major commitment to public policy and history?
Well, it means I wear major hats and have the privilege to work with many different groups, which I love doing, and hopefully bring these groups together or help bring them together to make a difference in the world. And I'm very privileged to be able to do that, just as I was extremely privileged and fortunate to spend 10 wonderful years here in Madison at the University of Wisconsin, which is a great university and a phenomenal place.
Makes you a little homesick being back for a couple days?
It does, and so many memories, and I feel such loyalty and affection for so many people here, and such sincere gratitude. And Madison will always be a part of our lives, intellectually, but even more so as a family.
What is the difference in the ambience, the personality of the two campuses now that you, and the University of Texas at Austin has a fine reputation.
Absolutely.
And people say, oh, love it there. It's kind of like Madison, but is it?
Well, there are some similarities. Austin has a sensibility of being a special place in a big state that's connected to the state, but different from a lot of the rest of the state, as Madison has that relationship with Wisconsin. It's got a great world-class university, as Madison does, and it draws people from all around the world, as Madison does. People in Austin, like those in Madison, really love being there. They're very enthusiastic. They never say, we're just here for a job. They say, we're here because we want to be in Austin. So those are the similarities. Two differences. Austin is a lot bigger. It's about 10,000 more students. And it has more things, in a sense, especially in public policy. The Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs is a big entity, much larger than any comparable entity in Madison. And there's more of a commitment to public policy issues, in part simply because of the Lyndon Johnson legacy in that area. That's a difference from Wisconsin. Another difference is the University of Wisconsin is very rooted still in progressive politics, and that's wonderful. Texas doesn't quite have that tradition to draw on.
Well, and yes, and in Texas now you have a presidential candidate that
yes,
in your midst.
Yes, but this is a similarity with Madison. Just as in Madison, Governor Walker is not the most popular person in Austin. It's very hard to find anyone who likes Governor Perry. And one difference, in Texas, the governor actually has very little power. In Wisconsin, the governor has much more power, actually.
Yes, yeah, that's a major difference. And that even came up during President Bush, George W. Bush, when he was running for president. They talked about the role of governor in Texas is really not that strong as it is in many other states.
That's right. In Texas, the
empowered.
The person who really runs Texas, especially the money, is the controller, which is not the governor, and that's an interesting phenomenon.
And they have a part-time legislature in Texas.
They do, which was a new thing to me, and I have to say, it's this year the legislature is not in session. They could be called into session if they have to be, but it seems to work well.
So they have jobs elsewhere.
Absolutely.
And then
Absolutely.
Provide their public service part-time to
Absolutely.
The state.
Absolutely. It used to be that way in Wisconsin. It was only about 30 years ago that Wisconsin changed to a full-time legislature.
Well, we could talk about this the rest of the show, and I don't want to because we're here to talk about what's another new thing in your life, which is another new book. And just as a little bit of background, you are the author of three books on contemporary politics and foreign policy, Henry Kissinger and the American Century. And you were on this program talking about that.
Yes.
And the Global Revolution of 1968. And the third book was Power and Protest. And you're also a frequent contributor to many newspapers and journals. And I won't begin to list all of those, but you were also awarded, named by Smithsonian Magazine and recognized as one of America's top young innovators in the arts and sciences. So you are still in... at the beginning of a burgeoning career.
Well.
But your latest book just was released, Liberty's Surest Guardian, American Nation Building from the Founders to Obama. And you are here in Madison to talk about the book, which you did yesterday at Rotary and at the Overture Center last night. And I understand there was an overwhelming crowd, an enthusiastic group of people. And before we go to break, let me just kind of set the scene with our listeners and start out by asking you, what is the definition of nation building?
That's a key question. One of the reasons I wrote this book, because it's a term we've used for a long time as a society. I think nation building is the effort to influence parts of our own society and other societies, not to tell them what to do, but to help them build institutions that allow them to govern themselves in ways that are orderly and compatible with the world we live in. So it's about self-interest, but it's also about trying to help other societies as well. It's about trying to build something that is in between a world of chaos and a world of empires, a world of self-governing entities.
And it doesn't mean that we're trying to create other societies that look like us and act like us and function like us.
No, it means that we're trying to create other societies that have institutions that sometimes approximate our own, but that have institutions that allow societies to follow their own values and their own culture. That's at least the goal of nation building. Empire would be more to impose our culture on other societies.
And you say that nation building is a part of our country's, of America's DNA.
Absolutely. I believe it's there from the start. It's one of the things that makes us exceptional. To say we're exceptional, though, does not mean we're better. But we had the opportunity in the 18th century, in part because we were a marginal place that the big European powers didn't care as much about. We had an opportunity, or at least a small group of Americans had an opportunity, to build a new nation that had not existed before. People didn't call themselves Americans before the late 18th century, and they didn't have an American government. That was created anew. And this experience of creating a new nation state, a new kind of sovereignty, a new kind of governance, that's built into the way we think about politics. And so when we become involved in other societies, whether we want to be there or not, it's what we often seek to do in those societies. It's what's different about us from how other countries operate.
And we would thank our founding fathers for establishing these roots and this foundation for our nation.
I think so, yes. And I think what the book tries to do is first articulate and acknowledge that, but also point out that having this framework, having this set of ideas that I think are good ideas personally, that's only the starting point. If we can acknowledge those, we then have to think about what are the best ways to put those into action. And the book goes through 200 years showing how the operationalizing, the application changes from time to time. It has to keep changing from time to time. Too often, I think, we try to do it the way we did it the last time rather than thinking about how the world has changed and how we have to do it anew this time.
And every area is a little bit different.
Absolutely. So to say that we have a consistent way of thinking about nation building, Carol, doesn't mean we should always do it the same way, nor that we should do it all the time. We should also recognize how difficult it is and recognize that if we're willing to do it, we have to be really committed. If we're not, we shouldn't do it.
Our guest today on All About Living, Professor Jeremy Suri, author of the new book, Liberty's Surest Guardian, American Nation Building from the Founders to Obama. And we're going to talk further with Professor Suri, with Jeremy, if I may say.
Please.
Find out some of these examples of nation building over the 200-year history of our country and what we can learn from that, and we can learn from history, and we can apply today.
I hope so.
I hope so. Yes, don't we all? You're listening to All About Living here on Madison 1670 WTDY, and we'll be right back with Jeremy Suri after these messages.
This is All About Living with Carol Colby, Madison 1670, WTDY.
All About Living here on Madison 1670 WTDY. I'm Carol Colby, and joining me today, Professor Jeremy Suri. For 10 years, was here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, an acclaimed history professor, now at the University of Texas at Austin. And he is here to talk to us about his newest book, Liberty's Surest Guardian, American Nation Building from the Founders to Obama. And this segment of our program is brought to you by Turville Bay MRI and Radiation Oncology Center in Madison, where expertise with compassion is powerful medicine. And perhaps expertise and compassion, that's part of nation building. Would those be two components that could be used in nation building as a description?
I think that's very well put, Carol, and they have to go together. Expertise without compassion can be deadly, because that involves, it's a point I make throughout the book, telling people how to live in ways that they don't want to live, which never works. And compassion without expertise can often mean doing things that are very destructive without realizing it. So I think one way of looking at this is nation building is an effort to bring the expertise we've garnered from our experiences together with a compassion and a willingness to understand and listen to other societies.
Listen.
Yes. Listening is, and that's often a hard thing for Americans. Mm-hmm. One of the points I make in the book, it's something I learned researching and writing this, is that there is perhaps an inverse relationship between how powerful and confident you are and how successful you can be in nation building. Because when you're very powerful and confident, as we were in the 1960s and 70s and as we were in 2002, 2003, and you think you have all the answers, that's when you stop listening to others and then you get into a lot of trouble.
Well, you have a vested interest in the role of history and the importance
Absolutely.
Of history as a history professor. But how powerful, what is the role of history in determining our current direction and how we move forward?
Great question.
How should we use history?
Great question. I think about this a lot. So there are three elements, I think, of this that at least for me are very important. First of all, history and understanding history helps explain where we are today. One of the reasons I wrote this book is because there are assumptions we have about nation building that are built into who we are because of our own experience, and we can't unthink those, even if we don't acknowledge them. We do believe the world, as Americans, we believe the world would be better if it looked more like us than the way it looks in other places, and because our institutions have worked reasonably well, even though they're filled with problems, as we know today. And that's something that we've inherited. We can't get rid of that, and we should recognize that. That can be a limitation as well as an opportunity. Second way history matters is history can give us a sense of best practices, what has worked, and in particular, what has not worked. So one of the points I make in the book is it's never worked for the United States to go into another society and say we're going in without other partners. We're always better off if we have real partners. Unilateralism does not work historically, even though we have this urge to be unilateralist. So there's sort of best practices that we can get from history. That's the second thing. And then the third and perhaps most important point is what I would call alternatives or imaginations. It's so easy, Carol, to think the world has to be the way it is because it is this way.
Mm-hmm.
And studying history should humble us all to see that many of the things we take for granted did not have to be the way they are. We should respect those, like Abraham Lincoln, who made extraordinary decisions to change the world. And we should also recognize that there were alternative paths that were not taken, that maybe should have been taken, and take inspiration from that today. So I'm not satisfied to go around criticizing the decision to go to war in Iraq, and I do criticize in the book, but that's not the point. The point is to say there were alternative paths we didn't take. Let's remember those alternative paths the next time something like this happens.
So as we make decisions going forward, perhaps going back into history and learning from what worked and what didn't work, applying those lessons to the decision-making as we're moving forward.
Correct. And also
could be helpful.
Running in our minds other alternatives, because you do find, I think we all find this in our lives, that big decisions come up and it seems like there's only one way to decide.
Mm-hmm.
Everything pushes you in that direction. But if you think historically, you say, well, other people sitting in these chairs made other decisions. Are those options open to me? And it's worth exploring them, even if you still end up doing the obvious thing. Too often, Carol, policymakers simply do the obvious because they don't have time. The most precious commodity is time in all of our lives. They're too busy answering their email, so they don't step back. The historian should not tell policymakers how to do their job, but the historian should say, before you make your decision, Miss Policymaker, please think about these other things and then make the decision you think is the right decision.
In your book, you cite several examples where America has been successful in nation building. Mm-hmm. And talk about some of those. And then I want to see how we could apply them to today's times.
Sure. Great. And that's exactly why I wrote the book.
By the way, I loved the book.
Oh, thank you.
I was so excited last night. I was telling my husband, and this morning, I learned so much. And I was just really singing the praises of the book.
Well,
and
I appreciate that.
And the substance that it gave me, a better understanding of the whole picture and how it all fits together. It's a very dynamic process. I mean,
absolutely.
History and current events, I mean, it all blends together.
Well, that's very nice of you to say. It means a lot to me. Thank you, Carol. What I argue in the book is, first of all, that success is never nirvana. Success always involves a whole new set of problems. But success means making a situation a bit better for long-term improvement. And the two cases I point to in particular as the norm for this sort of thing are Reconstruction in the South and the Philippines in the early 20th century, both of which were cases filled with problems, both of which were cases where the expectations were not met. And if anyone knows the history of the South in the late 19th century, early 20th century, it was still a very racially polarized society with Jim Crow, lynching, all sorts of problems. Same with the Philippines to some extent. But in both of these cases, Americans, the Union forces in the South after the Civil War, and American forces and civilians like William Howard Taft in the Philippines, were able to put processes into place that actually made these societies at least a little bit better and set them on a new trajectory, eliminating slavery in the South, creating a basis for African-American education and empowerment. Too little, but at least something there that changed the South. That's why the South looks the way it looks today and doesn't look the way it looked before. And in the Philippines, creating a basis for civilian governance in the Philippines, for representation, and for Filipino education in self-governance as well. None of this was done in a way that was altruistic. All of it served American interests. This is not altruism. But all of it made these societies better and more stable than they had been before. And that's what success looks like in politics. Germany, the chapter on Germany in the book, is the case of extreme success. And look at Germany today. But I think that was in part a set of the circumstances the United States was in. We should not expect to build Germanys everywhere we go. But we should say we can go into a society like the Confederacy, like the Philippines, and we can make life better if we're committed to it. And we can do it in ways that will improve the stability, the security, and the long-term prosperity of that region and our own society.
You particularly acknowledge the gifted capabilities of some individuals.
Yes.
That made this happen,
yes.
That made this successful.
Yes.
With the Philippines, it was William Howard Taft, but in post-war Germany was Herbert Hoover. And
yes.
This is the first singing praises of Herbert Hoover in my history knowledge that I have ever encountered. But he was absolutely brilliant. Well, it was brilliant of Truman to bring him
absolutely.
In.
Absolutely. Truman gets credit for that, right?
Yes. And his presidency was considered failed from my knowledge.
Absolutely.
But here, Truman knew this international capability he had, but it was more than that. It was a communication style.
Absolutely. One of the points I make in the book, and again, this is something I learned during the research. I didn't know I was going to
So you learned things.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. This book is very different from what I set out to write. I set out to write a book, Carol, just about the 20th century, and I realized all these issues go back much further. I realized figures who I didn't know much about, like William Howard Taft and Herbert Hoover, were much mm-hmm. more important. And one thing that comes through, I think, is that the figures who are often best at this are the figures who are very good at working with multiple groups of people. They are, I call them in the book, deal makers as much as they are eloquent speakers. This is really important, and it's something we undervalue in our society today. So this is part of my agenda in the book. Diplomacy, deal making, being able to work with people who have very different views of the world. This is how you get things done. Oliver Otis Howard does this in the American South. William Howard Taft does this in the Philippines. Herbert Hoover does this in Germany. We lack those people today because we don't train that. We spend too much time encouraging people to take strong positions and not compromise. And you're seen as a strong leader if you don't compromise. That's nonsense. That's a certain road to disaster, it seems to me. Politics is about having values, but also learning to work with people who have different values. And when we've succeeded best, it's when we've done that.
Well, if I understand correctly from reading the book, these people walked into these situations not with the idea of having those countries or those areas become little Americas.
No.
They went in with the insight immediately. They were there to have those people build their own cultures positively and for the societies to live respectfully and to honor the cultures.
Absolutely. I mean, Herbert Hoover is a great example of this, and he is an impressive figure. And he was, by the way, considered the most impressive figure of his time before the Depression. He had the misfortune of being president during the Depression. But Herbert Hoover had spent his early career, as I write about in the book, traveling around the world. He had been a self-made international geologist and engineer. He'd been in China, South Africa, everywhere. And he was convinced that the world was never going to look like the United States. But he was also convinced that people around the world wanted to work together if they could find it to be in their profitable interest and also in the interest of their security. And that was how he succeeded as a businessman. And he sought to do that at the end of World War I. He was the only person who came out of World War I successful. He found ways to get business groups in the U.S. to feed Europe out of their own self-interest, philanthropy, but also good business activities. During the 1920s, he created the Commerce Department. And after World War II, when the United States didn't know what to do in Germany, Harry Truman had the good sense to send him back because of his World War I experience, Herbert Hoover, to Europe. And this is what he did. The Marshall Plan was basically an idea not to give aid to governments. We were not giving it to people like Hamid Karzai as we do today. The money was being invested in local businesses, local unions of workers who would work with businesses. This was a pro-union policy, just as it was a pro-business policy, investing in their working together so they could say what they needed in their areas, and we could support things that would get their economies moving, get their infrastructure rebuilt, and establish local governance. And as Hoover always put it, the Germans and the British and the French, they have to own this, and we're investing in them. This was a business venture for political purpose. It was not free aid. It was not entitlement. And it wasn't about sending in military forces to take over a place either.
Well, it was interesting because he went in and looked at what are the smallest problems. If people are hungry,
exactly.
They don't want to sit and talk about the philosophy of the world and,
exactly.
You know, which leadership style should you envelop in your environment, that we need food.
Right. And he also recognized people who need food don't actually want handouts. They want to be empowered mm-hmm. to get their own food.
Mm-hmm.
So this was not about, the food aid was given, but it was about empowering exactly what you said, Carol, local families to have a means of believing that they'll be able to feed themselves going forward.
So starting with solving the problems of the individuals in the immediate, it's almost like Maslow's.
Absolutely.
Theory of self-actualization. You start with food, shelter, and water and those kinds of things. And if there were difficulties in those areas, solve that problem and solve it so that they can solve it for themselves and that it doesn't come back.
Exactly.
And then you build from that and there's building of a trust.
Absolutely.
And they're here to help. They're not here to take over.
Absolutely right. Absolutely.
And we're in this together.
That's exactly.
And we're all going to be better for it.
It's a partnership. What you're doing uh-huh. is you're building a partnership. And it requires what you said earlier, Carol, so well. It requires being willing to go in and listen. Not going in and telling people, I know what your problem is. I mean, okay, let me hear what your problem is and let me tell you how I think I can help you solve your problem, which will also help me too. And being direct and honest about that, this is where a businessman's sense can help in political activities.
Well, that came through loud and clear regarding Herbert Hoover in particular and how his communication was, I'm just there to listen.
Yeah.
I'm just there to listen.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he learned a lot and gained some respect for them that we needed perhaps to incorporate in our own lives.
Absolutely.
So it's
and
give and take.
And the other point that comes out in this is a lot of the people who the United States worked with in Germany and elsewhere were people who we morally didn't like. A lot of these people were former Nazis. We didn't work with those who were running the concentration camps, but we worked with a lot of people who had been working for the Nazi regime. We had to, Hoover said, because they actually knew how to do things.
Mm-hmm.
People who knew how to run the water, knew how to run the electricity, they had been Nazi employees. Can't go into a society and say we're going to get rid of all the people we don't like. That was a big mistake we made in Iraq.
Well, our guest today is Professor Jeremy Suri, author of the new book, Liberty's Surest Guardian, American Nation Building from the Founders to Obama. And we're going to stop for a break. And when we come back, let's talk about Vietnam, because you say in your book that nation building didn't work very well there.
It did not.
And we know what happened as a result. You're listening to All About Living here on Madison 1670 WTDY. We'll be right back after these messages.
This is All About Living with Carol Colby, Madison 1670, WTDY.
Welcome back. This segment of our program is brought to you by Oak Park Place. Live life, live well at Oak Park Place. Our guest today on All About Living, on a short visit to Madison from his new home at the University of Texas at Austin, Professor Jeremy Suri. Liberty's Surest Guardian, American Nation Building from the Founders to Obama, is his newest book, and he's here to talk about it. He is a historian of great note, named one of Smithsonian Magazine's top young innovators in the country. And this book talks about nation building, and we, before the break, we talked about some of the successes of nation building. And it's not that it's utopia, but it situations that are improved and that work for the betterment of societies, for America, and for the society that is being reconstructed as the South after the Civil War, the Philippines, post-World War II, Germany. These are successful stories of nation building. Not perfect. Germany worked out pretty well. Yeah. But then you talk about Vietnam, and our nation-building success kind of floundered there.
Yes, I think Vietnam was pretty close to a disaster for a number of reasons. But the biggest one that stands out to me is that Americans thought they were doing nation-building there, but they thought they could do it alone. And part of the problem is that Americans thought they were all powerful and all knowing. They had expertise without compassion, in a sense. And they forgot that there were people on the ground. They didn't listen. They didn't have the Herbert Hoover figures, the people who were guiding American action in Vietnam, who were better trained to do what they were doing, but not well trained to understand the people who they were interacting with. In addition, as I point out, there was a clear figure on the ground who had legitimacy in the eyes of many Vietnamese, had experience, had thought through these issues, and was never going to be an ally, but someone that we refused to work with, and that was Ho Chi Minh. And this comes back to the point that you brought out, Carol, so well in the last segment, which is the need to work with multiple kinds of people. Again, Ho Chi Minh was a communist, and he was not going to change. But there were ways we could have worked with him, and he did work with us a little bit during World War II. But we refused, because of our extreme anti-communism, to be willing to work with him. And I take that as a warning for the world of today. We should have strong moral opinions, but we should also recognize that strong moral opinions should not cut us off to investigating partnerships, even with people who we might at first glance not like and even not believe are on the right moral track.
Well, in the case of Ho Chi Minh, he had paid his dues. He had been there for years and years, and he was there for the people, and he understood the culture.
That's right.
The people could count on him. And when they're fearful, insecure, when they don't have the necessities of life, and there's someone there who knows them and is one of them that they can count on, that's who it's almost in our own individual DNA to turn to people like that.
Absolutely. And we're never going to be able to compete with someone like that for image. Again, this doesn't mean that we had to give in to all of his demands, but there were ways we could have worked with him. And we did not explore those sufficiently because we thought we didn't have to. We thought we were powerful enough to avoid that.
So then moving quickly, fast forwarding to Iraq and Afghanistan. Afghanistan first, because after 9/11, that was our first infiltration.
Right.
And you quote George W. Bush, and he seemed to, in his speeches, get it, that about the concept of nation building and building better societies, and not necessarily everything becoming America,
right,
but building better societies.
And I think that became evident, even though his administration before September 11th, 2001 was committed to not nation building, that the point of my book is when bad things happen, we immediately return to that. We become most idealistic at our moments when we feel most threatened. And seeing how a failed state in Afghanistan, a place we had been involved in and left without nation building in 1989 after the defeat of the Soviet Union, seeing how that became a haven for people bringing horror to the world, convinced Americans very quickly that we had to do something to help get a good state, a nation state, functioning in Afghanistan. And by the way, Afghanistan had one in the late 60s and early 70s. So the Bush administration did what anyone in the White House would have done after September 11th, which was go after the terrorists in Afghanistan, and they did it reasonably well. And they immediately flipped into trying to nation build in Afghanistan. And I think there were great opportunities. It never would have been perfect. It always would have been difficult. But there were opportunities in part because we have pretty clear evidence that the people of Afghanistan, despite their many differences, they wanted something better also. And they were involved in a process through bond negotiations in Bonn, Germany to do this. The big problem was the United States felt coming out of the Vietnam War that we should do this with minimal investment, number one, and number two, that we should also go to war in Iraq. And that distraction took us away from the work that was to be done in Afghanistan.
So the combination of not investing enough plus spreading ourselves too thin.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And once we lost the trust of the Afghanis or lost the little trust we had, I think they were still skeptical from the start, but they also believed we were better than the others. But once we just started to look like we didn't care, they would never regain trust of us. Why would they?
Because we left them.
Yeah.
Well, but you said Afghanistan went relatively smoothly at first, and maybe we got a little pumped up. Well,
yeah.
This isn't difficult.
Absolutely.
And so we can go into Iraq and do the same thing, and that was a different culture.
Absolutely.
Here again, it's got to be customized, that we can't expect all cultures and all peoples to be the same.
Great point. Another reason why history is so important. What we tend to do when we make policy is we do what we think worked or avoid doing what we think didn't work in the last case. But history is much longer than just the last case. We need to look at the 200 years, not just the last case we lived in, because what worked in one place might not work in the next. And if you look at a variety of cases, as I try to in this book, over 200 years, you can see just your point. You can see the differences among places.
Now, the question that came to mind, and I didn't see this strongly addressed in your book, but when I think of Afghanistan and the cultures and the strong, the fundamentalist, extreme Islamic influence, and in particular their treatment of women and how the core family is really not there. That's not a solid foundation of a civilized society, of the way we want people to be treated. How can we work with that? Because that's their fundamental religious views.
Well, I think, first of all, there's a fair amount of diversity within those views. But yes, they have a different, many people in that part of the world have a different outlook from us, and they're entitled to. We don't have to like it. But we can work with the Afghanis, I think, in particular, because there are people accustomed to working with foreigners. It's true that it's been very difficult for foreigners to dominate Afghanistan, but people have been operating in that space for a long time. And Afghanis are very cosmopolitan. They're very accustomed to working with foreigners. And we share a lot of interests. Most Afghans, regardless of what their religious point of view is, as you just said, care about family. Care about community. And most of them don't want to see someone destroy their lives. They want to see a government that will actually preserve stability. They want a government that will provide security. And that's in our interest, too.
Well, one of the things that it's been going on, because I strongly feel that the woman, you know, how women are treated
Yes.
reflects how society is treated. And they have not treated women well.
That's true.
And Greg Mortensen went in and mm-hmm. he set up his school for girls. And Julia Bowles from Madison, who is over there,
yes.
and she is setting up educational programs, really focusing on girls and women. And perhaps this is what nation building is. It doesn't happen overnight. It takes a long, long time. But if women can get educated and realize they don't need to be treated that way and refuse to be treated that way, maybe that's when change will occur.
Absolutely right. And
they have to own it, as you
say. They have to own it. And one of the themes throughout the book is that education is a key part of this. But not education just to fill tests and numbers, but educating people to be functioning members of a society, and women in particular, given that opportunity, is crucial.
We need to stop for a break, and we'll be back with our final segment with Jeremy Suri after these messages from our sponsors. You're listening to All About Living here on Madison 1670 WTDY, also available on carolcobyradio.com. And if you're out of the listening area, you can always listen live. All programs are streamed on WTDY.com. We'll be right back after
these
messages.
And we're back with our program. This segment is brought to you by Gunderson Funeral and Cremation Care, the Life Celebration Center. We're here with our last few minutes with Professor Jeremy Suri, a history professor now at the University of Texas at Austin. It's hard for me to say that. You were 10 years, you were here, mm-hmm. one of our stellar professors who worked so well with the community and reaching out and making sure that we understood the really critical importance of history in our current times and as we move forward. You have a new book, Liberty's Surest Guardian, American Nation Building from the Founders to Obama. We've been talking about the success and failures throughout our 200-plus-year history here in the United States of America.
And when you spoke to Rotary, you mentioned that we have a great opportunity in the Middle East to do some nation building, and wouldn't it be wonderful if we could learn from the successful lessons of the past and apply those? And as we are taping this program, we just received news, and I assume it's accurate, that Gaddafi has been killed,
right,
that he is dead.
Right.
And this is a major, major step in a change in the Middle East that might be an opportunity for us.
Absolutely. I think what's happening in the Middle East today could be one of the most promising moments. It could turn out to be a disaster, too, but it could be one of the most promising moments for all of us who care about that region and care about our own societies that are dependent to some extent on that region. People from Libya to Tunisia to Egypt to Syria are trying to take control of their own governments, and they're trying to push out these long-serving dictators who, quite frankly, have been horrible to the people of that regime and horrible to our interests because they blame us for their problems even though we're the ones who support them. So our friends turn out to be our enemies with the people of that region. So this is an enormous opportunity from a strategic as well as a moral point of view. Now, we as a society right now are also dealing with huge budget problems, so we don't have a lot of money to spend. And we've learned that sending troops to that region doesn't solve a lot of problems. This is exactly why we need to think about nation building, because there are things we can do, especially in partnership with many other societies, as we have done to some extent in Libya, that could have a real positive difference and not be very costly to us. And I want to underline that. And for example, I think many of these societies are looking to find more ways to connect with Americans, even if they're not pro-American per se. They want to do business with our society. They want to understand our society. They want to feel we care about them. I would love to see us as a society do more to, first of all, talk about these issues, let them know we care, and to send more of our young people to these regions. We have so many wonderful young people, my students, students of my colleagues and others, who are entering a job market where there aren't many opportunities. This should be a Peace Corps moment. This should be a moment to invest in that kind of stuff. It's very inexpensive. It's good for young people. It will give them experience. I think that's money that's well spent, and it's a lot less than what we spend on a lot of fancy military hardware.
Doesn't the Peace Corps do that? Isn't that what the purpose of the Peace Corps?
They do, but I think it's time to sort of revamp this for a new world.
Okay.
I think in the Middle East, we're not sending people to go build toilets and latrines. Mm. I think we're sending people to be diplomats.
So have people, young people emerged right in their culture and work with the people.
Exactly. Exactly. And put, for instance, new emphasis on training Americans to speak the languages in the region. We talked about listening, Carol, right? How do you listen to people if you can't speak their language?
Are we too impatient of a society, though, to allow something long-term to really unfold?
Well, we are impatient, but we also have proven historically, this is where history matters, that we can make long-term commitments. That's what the Cold War was all about. To some extent, that's what our commitment to Germany and Western Europe has been all about. We still have forces in Western Europe. It's more than 50 years after the end of World War II, and they still play an important role there. And as we're seeing all the trouble in Europe, it's crucial that we remain involved there. So if we have leaders who make the case to us, and if we do it in a way that's cost efficient, that's really important. We can't just throw money at things. We can make long-term commitments. We are capable of that. We are better than many of our leaders think we are as a society.
And you think if Barack Obama begins to incorporate more of this kind of thinking, that he still has time to move forward in his presidency to make good things happen?
I think so. I think there's still time. I think his instincts are good, but he seems to often not want to lead on these issues. And I think, as I've written in the book and written elsewhere, I think he needs to focus on priorities. People feel they're getting too many things thrown at them. Say this is a priority. If we're going to have a jobs program, let's connect it to this. Maybe our jobs program should be to actually get our young people more internationally involved.
We have less than a minute left, so I'm just going to say you have five P's in the book that you say is important as a nation for us to move forward and be successful in nation building.
Yes.
And for our country and for the world and for the societies that we're working with.
Yes.
And that's partners. We need to be partners with other people. We need to look at the process. We need to solve the problems, starting with the small problems first. We have to have a purpose. Why are we doing that? And it's people that move history and not big events.
Absolutely.
But it's individuals.
Absolutely. And I think we need to remember those issues every time we think about whether we're going to do something like this or not.
And I found it interesting, one of the points that you made, the role of a president, three things a president can do, because really with some of these things, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, what they say in the campaign, the president has no power to do it. But a president can do three things. One is appoint skilled transitional leaders, such as selecting a Herbert Hoover, encourage debate among the citizens, and educate citizens, really deeply educate about what the real facts are.
Absolutely. And I'd like to see our president do that today.
Thank you so much, Jeremy Suri. I can't recommend the book strongly enough, Liberty's Surest Guardian, American Nation Building from the Founders to Obama. And thank you, Morgan Welk, for your great producing. And thank you for listening to All About Living here on Madison 1670 WTDY. I'm Carol Kobe. Now go out and have a great rest of the weekend.